48. Watch the throne. The customized Ubriquian space yacht dropped out of hyperspace, flanked by a complement of 6 Z-95 headhunters, all of them materializing at once into the void immediately outside the short-range detection systems of Coghive 7. For a moment, nothing seemed to move. The minstrel-class yacht, christened Star Jewel, appeared to hang suspended almost lazily in space, as if evaluating its options. Opulent to the point of obscenity, the Jewel was as lethal as it was extravagant. Its optimized CL-14 hyperdrive motivator had made the journey from Hutt space through the trialist trade route almost too swiftly for the purposes of its owner, who had expressed emphatic interest along the way in building an even greater appetite in the Kell dragons he'd kept chained in his throne room. When they'd left Nalhutta, the dragons were already hungry. By the time the hyperdrives settled into silence, the creatures were literally drooling on the throne room floor. Now, seated before the great transparasteel dome in all his vast draconian majesty, Jabba Dasilajic Teur turned from his beloved dragons to gaze outward into the vast expanse of nothingness, none of which belonged to him, although he felt right at home here. It hadn't been too terribly long ago, really just a few short centuries, since he'd relocated his base of operations to the Ba'omar Monastery on Tatooine. And he was still young enough that such unexpected jaunts across the galaxy appealed to the daring side of his nature. Everything had gone as expected. There was no sign of the target that had brought them here. Not yet, although there was no rush. The Jewel's crew, the usual entourage of slave girls, carnivorous pets, and cutthroat enforcers, Trandoshans, Gran, and Gamorreans, made the final preparations for their own dark business here, an opportunity that Jabba, having come so far, had no intention of letting slip away.
Ramp down the turbo lasers.
He activated the comm link to the Jewel's bridge, where his pilot and second-in-command, Scuppa, had sequestered himself for the duration of the trip.
Power all systems down to silence. I want no detectable heat signature from the ion engines until my signal.
The order had the expected results. Seconds later, Scuppa himself appeared in the throne room, expressing himself with characteristic bluntness.
I don't like this.
Scuppa, my boy, come closer and join the party.
Beckoning the pilot toward himself and the rabble surrounding him, Jabba grinned.
Surely you don't think you're better than us?
I never said.
Good. Squeamishness is for the weak.
Jabba waved him over, taking perverse delight in the pilot's reluctance. It wasn't that Scuppa had any qualms about mingling with the exotic concubines, pirate muscle, or low-level hangers-on that were currently amusing themselves, taunting the Kell dragons. He simply wasn't comfortable being away from the ship's navigational system when they were this far off the trade route. After all, one never knew what trouble one might run into in the Outer Rim.
We won't have to wait long now.
It's a mistake to power down the turbo lasers. If the prison barge gets the drop on us...
They won't.
Jabba reached down for the bowl beneath his hookah and drew out a Clatooine patty frog, dropping the unfortunate creature live and squirming into his mouth.
I've already dispatched the Star Jewel's guard to locate them before they find us.
Another bad idea.
Scupper's lower lip reshaped itself into an even more displeased moo.
With the headhunters gone, we're already more exposed than ever.
Relax, Scupper. It's almost time. Sit down. Enjoy the show.
He gestured to the open area directly below his throne. The pilot remained standing in the open hatchway while two of Jabba's bodyguards, a psychopathic Gamorrean war criminal and a dwarf Oskin Bloodeater, thrashed in mortal combat across the floor in front of where Jabba himself was seated, just outside the reach of the Keldragons. Within a few seconds, the Bloodeater had slashed open the Gamorrean's face and latched onto him to feed. Already Jabba felt himself growing bored, restless in the way that all too often characterized the final moments before he allowed himself the full gratification of settling the business at hand. Today, that business was revenge. Over the past 3 years, the credits that he'd lost to Iram Radik's arms sales had metastasized from a minor annoyance to an intolerable insult. Even so, Jabba had been prepared to absorb a certain degree of indignity, at least temporarily. In his almost 600 years of experience as a crime lord, he discovered that men like Radik rarely lasted long enough to bother with. Even when they took ingenious measures to protect themselves, like disappearing into the woodwork of Coghive 7, as Radik had, it was simply a matter of time before they backed the wrong army, allied themselves with the wrong crime syndicate, sold guns to the wrong separatists. After a meteoric rise in reputation, they invariably disappeared without a trace, never to be spoken of again. Jabba, in his great leniency and mercy, had decided that he would stand by and allow Radik to fall victim to his own success. For the time being, he would continue to send his men into the prison as guards to discover the arm dealer's identity, but nothing more. But things had changed on Coghive 7. As of yesterday, they had changed very quickly indeed. Of course, Jabba hadn't been personally attached to any of the lackeys he'd sent into the prison undercover, but to stand by and allow his own people to be slaughtered, ripped apart, and devoured by the inmates of the prison, while the prison's female warden stood by grinning like a monkey lizard, was an affront to the very pillars of his authority. Watching his foot soldiers being destroyed, Jabba had made up his mind that if he couldn't put Iram Radik out of business, then he would simply destroy Coghive 7 completely. Ultimately, it would prove both simpler and far more gratifying. And he'd realized immediately how to do it. An alarm sounded on the control panel beside his throne, the signal of an incoming transmission from the pilot of one of the headhunters.
Transport ship in sight,
the pilot reported back.
We're closing in on her now.
Jabba saw Scuppa straighten up in anticipation, while down below the throne, the Bloodeater finished its meal to the scattered applause of the others. The Gamorreans and Trandoshans were as eager as he was to get on with their true business at hand.
Get to the armory,
Jabba told them.
Suit up.
He turned to Scuppa.
You should be relieved, my friend. I'm going to let you reactivate your turbo lasers.
Within minutes, the prison transport barge Purge had drifted into attack range. Although Jabba had ordered Scuppa to ignore any request from the Purge's captain to identify himself. Failure to respond to the prison barge's hailing frequency had resulted in the anticipated result. The barge had brought its own weapon systems online, under the assumption that the Star Jewel was a pirate vessel or worse.
I'm speaking to the captain of the unidentified space yacht.
The voice of the Purge's captain through the intercom sounded strained with impatience.
You are in a designated approach corridor for prison transport to Coghive 7. Identify yourself at once, or you'll be fired on.
Scuppa's voice, equally anxious, crackled through the Jules comlink.
Jabba, how much longer?
Easy, friend.
Jabba waited, a smile writhing over his lips, saturating his entire face with the pleasure of impending attack. Silently counting off the seconds, he peered out the dome, yellow eyes gleaming with excitement as he gazed out on the purge. Down below, the Trandoshans and Gamorreans had gone to the armory to suit up and prepare the weapons. The throne room was almost empty, except for the dragons. XLIX, Cabal. Maul's first impression of the weapons shop was that it was more of a surgeon's operating room than a workspace. A long, brightly illuminated theater of apparent sterility, whose every surface seemed polished and clean. At the moment, however, he was more preoccupied with the identity of the one who'd beckoned him inside.
"Come in,"
the moon said, still standing inside the open hatchway.
"I just got here myself."
He smiled thinly.
"We've both certainly earned a look around, to say the least."
Maul regarded him coldly. Whatever else he might have been, the individual standing in front of him clearly wasn't a prisoner of the Hive. His uniform was IBC standard fiduciary garb, the green tunic and trousers exactly what one would expect of a galactic financial executive. The banking clan's presence here, in an illegal weapons operation in the middle of a prison, raised more questions than it answered.
"I'm Vestal Slipher,"
the moon said. And then, as if reading Maul's thoughts, he added,
"Believe it or not, my purposes here aren't entirely at odds with yours. Not as much as you might think. But please, step inside."
Maul entered the chamber and looked around, his mind quickly absorbing and processing a dozen different details simultaneously. The shop was swarming with activity. Inmates he'd never seen before, human and non-human alike, stood in rows before the assembly tables, sorting components from different crates, passing them back and forth among themselves, putting them together by sense of touch. Maul stood observing them for a long moment, trying to process what it was that bothered him about them. They functioned in nearly total silence, but there was something peculiar about them that he couldn't quite put his finger on, until one of them raised his face in Maul's direction. And then he saw. They had no eyes. Their empty eye sockets were caves of blindness, raw and dark and hollow. After a moment, the inmate who'd been facing Maul turned back down to the partially assembled weapon in front of him and returned to his work.
"Radik removes the eyes," Slipher said conversationally. "Apparently it's a prerequisite to working down here. Another safeguard, I suppose. A means of preserving absolute secrecy."
Maul said nothing. He was remembering his very first day in the mess hall, the blind inmates that he'd noticed sitting off by themselves, groping with their food and utensils. That was how they lived. Now, except for the soft click and snap of assembled parts, the only sound was the faint rustle of the clawbirds, who had settled into the far corner of the room, into a kind of makeshift nesting area.
"What are they still doing here if Radik is dead? Don't they know?"
A flicker of motion caught his attention from the far end of the shop. There was someone in the corner, his wrists and ankles bound. A guard that Maul recognized. The one called Smite. He'd been gagged, but his eyes were huge, gleaming with a mixture of anger, fear, and confusion.
"Ah, yes,"
Slipher said, noticing that Maul was looking at the guard.
"Apparently, we're not the only ones who found ourselves down here. I'm quite sure Mr. Radik would not like the idea of an intruder ransacking his arsenal. Would you?" particularly someone as unsavory as Mr. Smite here.
Radik is dead,
Mo said.
I killed him.
Dead?
Slipher glanced at him for a moment, then laughed.
That's funny, he said. You know, for a moment I almost believed you.
It's true.
Oh no, Iram Radik is very much alive, I assure you. The Weequay that you killed in that last bout was a proxy. Radik has a dozen of them in circulation at any time to ensure his own safety.
How do you know?
Maul asked. Instead of answering, the moon turned to look at the rows of blind inmates as they painstakingly assembled the components on the tables in front of them.
Do you know what they're building?
Weapons.
Not just weapons, Slipher said. Lightsabers.
Maul felt something go tight in his chest.
What?
Synthetic lightsabers, Radik's newest innovation. A radical departure from anything that's been accomplished up to this point. Apparently it works on a synth crystal.
The moon walked over to the end of a long counter and picked up a sleek red gem, holding it up admiringly to catch the light.
They're baked in a geological compressor. Can you imagine the power inside just one of these?
Ah,
a voice spoke from behind him.
But power is in the eye of the beholder, is it not?
Maul knew who it was even before he turned around and looked down. Coyle was standing there peering up at him.
What are you doing here?
I called him down, Zero said, as he stepped through the hatchway and sealed it shut behind him.
After I sent a message summoning Mr. Slipher, I felt like it was time we all met face to face.
Maul stared at him.
The poison,
he began, and then he remembered the one who had first told him about it.
Coyle smiled and gave him a slight, apologetic shrug as if to say, what is life but a riddle that none of us can answer?
You really think you could have slipped anything remotely dangerous into my food without my being alerted about it first? Zero asked.
Jagannath. You continue to surprise me.
Maul looked at their faces from Zero to Coyle to Slipher and then back to Zero again.
You've found your way to Radik's inner circle, Zero told him.
The backbone cabal, if you like. The Clawbirds recognized it when they brought you here. Zero reached down into the crate behind him, drawing a blaster rifle from inside it and pointing it at Maul's chest.
Unfortunately, this is where it ends for you. You've seen too much. Mr. Radik would never allow you to leave.
Maul looked back at the rows of eyeless inmates, hunched before the workstations, silently assembling the weapons. A possibility had taken shape in his mind without his realizing it, but he saw it now clearly.
They're not functioning properly, are they?
He asked. Zero hesitated. What?
Radik's synthetic lightsabers. The crystals aren't working like he thought they would.
How did you? Slipher began, but Zero silenced him with a look.
We're having no such problems.
Tucking the blaster rifle under his arm, Zero walked over to the workspace, reached into the packing crate, and pulled out a long, cylindrical shaft, holding it up for inspection.
Then you won't mind a demonstration,
Maul said.
Go ahead.
He took a step forward, tipping back his head to expose his throat.
Use it on me.
For a long moment, Zero didn't move or speak. Then, With the lightsaber still in one hand and the blaster in the other, the Twi'lek turned to look across the workspace to where the guard, Smite, was still glaring at them with a gag in his mouth, his hands and ankles bound.
"Bring him over here," he said.
Coyle walked over to Smite and, with strength that belied his size, he picked up the guard and slung him over his shoulder like a sack of laundry, carrying him over to Zero.
"Cut him loose," Zero said.
And when the Chadrafan hesitated,
"Go ahead. He's not going anywhere."
Shrugging, Coyle plucked a sharpened, question-mark-shaped object from his back pocket. Some claw or tooth from some lesser species, no doubt scavenged from one of his sculptures, and hooked it through the plastic restraints on the guard's wrists, snapping them free. Zero turned to Smite.
"Take this," Zero said, handing the lightsaber to the guard and nodding at Maul. "And kill the Zabrak."
Smite stared at the lightsaber. The gag was still over his mouth, but Maul could see all kinds of things going on in the guard's face. Anger, humiliation, uncertainty, and ultimately, a kind of murderous resolve. He flicked the switch. A narrow red beam shot out from the lightsaber's hilt. The beam was thinner than any that Maul had seen before. And instead of humming, it crackled and hissed unsteadily from base to tip. Weird, oscillating skeins of plasma writhed up and down the length of the beam like hundreds of semi-transparent serpents. On the whole, it looked even more unstable than the man holding it.
"Go ahead," Zero said. A terrible kind of righteousness came over Smite's face,
as if, in grasping this weapon, even in its most bastardized state, he'd arrived at a moment of supreme, almost sacred, self-actualization. He lifted it up over his head, preparing to bring it down on Maul's exposed throat. He was still swinging it down when the blade arced sideways, looping back on itself. Maul saw it slash around like the tail of a scorpion, something alive and venomous, hooking through Smite's face and carving it cleanly in half, then jerking sideways. The guard didn't have time to scream. His right arm hit the floor, the red blade still flicking and leaping erratically from his limp fingers, chopping what remained of Smite's body to pieces before it finally crackled and died out in a spreading lake of dark arterial blood.
They all took a step back from what remained of the corpse.
Coyle mumbled something under his breath. Zero was staring at the malfunctioning lightsaber, his face unreadable. Slipher looked as if he was going to be sick.
"Well,"
Maul nodded at the synthetic lightsaber.
"Mr. Radik won't be pleased with that."
With a grunt, Zero brandished the blaster rifle he picked up earlier.
"Forget that. We don't need it to kill you."
"I could help you with your problem,"
Maul said. Slipher was watching him very closely now, alternating glances between him and Zero.
"How?"
"When I was a mercenary, I assassinated a Jedi once,"
Maul said.
"It gave me the opportunity to study his lightsaber closely, to disassemble it. I was able to reverse engineer the components themselves, to study its design. I could fix what's wrong with these."
"You're lying,"
Zero said. His finger tightened on the blaster's trigger.
"You'll say whatever you have to in order to save your skin. And now, you're..."
"Stop."
The voice on the intercom was not one that Maul had heard before. It rang out through the shop, clear and deep and resonant, filling all available space. At the sound of it, every one of the blind inmates at the long counters stopped what they were doing and turned their faces upward, as if they could somehow see who was addressing them. Zero, too, was looking up at the recessed speakers in the ceiling of the room.
though he still kept the blaster trained on Maul. Mr. Radik?
Let the Zabrak speak.
Maul bent down and picked up the blood-soaked lightsaber from the disfigured corpse that had once been Seo Smite. Working quickly, without speaking a word, he snapped open the latch on the hilt and tipped it forward, allowing the various micro-components to slide out into his hand. It took less than 10 seconds for him to sort through them, plucking out the synth crystal and holding it up for inspection.
This is worthless.
Maul dropped the crystal to the floor and crushed it under his heel.
Your process is flawed. It's too unstable. It's possible that your geological compressor isn't generating sufficient heat and pressure to fully fabricate the proper crystalline structure. All these lightsabers are going to do is kill their users.
He lifted his head upward in the direction of the voice.
I can make them function properly.
There was silence in the room. It seemed to go on for a very long time.
But I need something from you in return.
Maul said.
You know what it is.
The silence came again, longer this time. Unbearable. Maul waited. An eternity. And another.
Kill him,
the voice said. And Zero pulled the trigger.
Behind the mask.
The Twi'lek's finger was still tightening on the blaster's trigger when Maul threw the disassembled lightsaber at him. The pieces struck Zero flush in the face, more of a distraction than anything else, but it bought Maul enough time to lunge at him, knocking the Twi'lek to the floor. The blast he was firing went wild, caroming off the ceiling and ricocheting to the floor. Maul took hold of Zero's throat, already knowing that killing him was pointless, that there was no way out of here, even if he slaughtered all of them, that in finding what he'd been sent to find, he'd only signed his own death warrant. It was too late now. Even Zero seemed to realize that. On the floor beneath Maul, he was shaking his head, laughing at him bitterly.
You idiot!
The Twi'lek said, spitting blood.
You think this is going to solve anything?
Maul didn't answer. He drove his fist into Zero's chin, and to his great surprise, he felt the inmate's entire face shiver and go sideways, his flesh appearing to split open and then peel back with a gelatinous suddenness so unexpected that Maul stopped his attack and stared down at him. The Twi'lek mask was dangling halfway off the newly exposed face of the man underneath him. Maul stared at him, stunned. He knew this face, or one very like it. It was the Warden of Coghive 7, Siddiqui Blur, but in a masculine form.
He says that you answer to another name.
Dakarai?
Vesto Slipher said. The moon sounded even more shocked than Maul felt.
What?
Dakarai Blur rose to his feet and tore the rest of the mask away from his face, flinging it away, where it landed on the floor in a misshapen heap. He looked completely indifferent to Slipher, and to Maul for that matter. His full attention was focused on the ceiling.
I can explain!
Dakarai said quickly, and Maul realized two things simultaneously. First, Dakarai was talking to the voice that had given him the instruction to kill, the voice of Iram Radik. And second, Dakarai was very scared, for reasons Maul could not determine.
I needed the disguise to move among the inmates, the man said, in order to program the algorithm. It allowed me to serve you as well as my sister. Neither of you needed to know. Neither of you could know. It was really the perfect solution. I could meet with you as Zero, and...
Finish him, Coil,
the voice said.
Wait, Dakarai said. You don't have to do this! You can just...
The Chadra Fan acted without hesitation. Picking up the blaster rifle that Dakari had been holding just seconds earlier, Coyle pointed it at him and fired, discharging a single shot. The point-blank impact flung Dakari's body backwards across the shop, and he landed in a lifeless heap beneath one of the assembly tables.
Mr. Slipher,
the voice on the intercom said, as if nothing had happened.
You may proceed as planned.
There was a pause.
Take the Zabrak with you.
Vesto Slipher managed a queasy nod.
Yes, Mr. Radik.
Without bothering to look back at Maul, he started out the door. Maul followed.
'51 To the hold.
The trip only took a few minutes, although to Maul's mind it seemed to go on much longer. He stood beside Vesto Slipher in the turbo lift, both of them staring straight ahead, neither one speaking. Too many things had happened too close together, and Maul needed time to process them all. The revelation of Zero's actual identity had clearly been a surprise to everyone, including Radik himself. Yet in a way it made perfect sense. As Inmate Zero, Dakari had been able to help the arms dealer coordinate the arriving weapon shipments while monitoring the inmate populace and programming Coghive 7's matching algorithm. Keeping secrets from Radik and his sister must have felt like the perfect double life. His mistake had been thinking he could mislead everyone indefinitely. And Radik himself. Maul couldn't stop thinking about that voice. Its unfathomable strength and power. His thoughts flashed back to the way that, when it spoke, every one of the blind prisoners, rows of convicts who'd willingly given their eyes to serve him here, had turned their faces upward toward it, as if toward deliverance itself. It made him wonder if this man really was a man at all, or something else altogether. The turbo lift continued its steady ascent.
What's in the cargo bay?
Maul asked finally. Slipher kept his eyes straight ahead.
Mr. Radik is having a new geological compressor delivered with today's shipment.
His voice still sounded unsteady.
I've arranged to have it received via binary lifter and held for me there.
So he knew there was something wrong with his lightsabers.
I'm assuming he did. He seems to know everything else.
Well, the moon considered. Almost everything.
How long have you worked for Radik?
Worked for him?
Slipher gave a dry chuckle. It came out eerie and humorless, like the nervous tick of a condemned man.
Technically, I still don't. I came to Coghive 7 as an employee of the IBC. And I'm here representing other interests as well.
He tugged at his collar and swallowed audibly.
You might say that I was unexpectedly recruited by Mr. Radik during my tenure here. My understanding is that's how it works.
How what works?
His whole empire. One often finds oneself serving his purposes without realizing it.
Maul grunted. The interior lights of the turbo lift flickered off for a span of several seconds. And the faint illumination of the object in Slipher's hand, the thing he'd called the Blue Witch, emanated up over their faces in an eerie blue glow. Maul peered at it incuriously. According to the banker, the device masked them from all electronic surveillance inside Coghive 7. They'd been using it in Radik's weapons shop, though for how long he didn't know. Certainly such a device would come in handy in a place where all the walls had surveillance cameras mounted within them.
We both find ourselves in the same regrettable situation,
the moon said.
We are dutiful servants dispatched into this floating landfill, forbidden to leave until we provide our masters with the information they seek.
He gave a melancholy sigh.
I might as well be wearing an inmate number myself.
You know nothing of my mission.
Slipher gave him a glance, cocking an eyebrow.
I know you're here on behalf of the Bandor Gora,
he said, in an effort to procure some unthinkably destructive weapon and put it in their hands. He cast Maul a sidelong glance.
Does that summarize it properly?
Maul said nothing. For a moment he entertained the notion of simply killing this self-pitying plutocrat right here in the lift, snatching the Blue Witch and finding the load-lifter droid himself. What could Slipher's presence here possibly bring to their arrangement now, except the ever-present possibility of betrayal?
Money stands at the nexus of all things, the moon said. Those who moderate its ebb and flow inevitably find themselves at the confluence of the galaxy's deepest secrets. Even the most confidential information arrives almost as an afterthought.
Do you ever stop talking?
Slipher sniffed, seeming only moderately offended.
I was merely explaining how I ended up in this position.
Maul kept his arms at his sides, but his fists were already clenched. Visions of leaving Slipher here in the turbo lift with a broken neck were growing steadily more vivid in his mind.
Your position here is hopeless, you know,
Slipher told him.
Even if you were successful in bringing them here, Radik will never do business with the Bandor Gora.
We'll see,
Maul said.
And of course you know that Komari Vozai is in charge of the Gora now.
He tilted his chin slightly, raising the witch in his hand.
You are familiar with Voza's background, are you not?
More underworld scum. The galaxy's thick with it.
Not quite. Voza is the high priestess of the cult. I'm told that she maintains a fortified citadel in Kolmar, and uses narcotics and advanced mind control to manipulate an entire army of operatives and assassins to do her bidding.
And then, almost as an afterthought,
and of course she's still extremely lethal with a lightsaber.
Maul shot the moon a look of thinly veiled shock.
What?
Oh yes, she's a former Jedi, Slipher said casually.
Surely, given your background, I'm not telling you anything that you don't already know.
At first, Maul said nothing. At his sides, his hands had already balled into fists, squeezing tightly until they began to tremble.
What else do you know about her?
Who? Voza?
The moon feigned innocence.
Oh, very little, I'm afraid. Her nearly psychopathic levels of aggression apparently prevented her from becoming a true Jedi Knight.
Nonetheless, she joined a Jedi task force to stop the Bandor Gora's activities on Baltazar. His expression darkened.
Unfortunately, the mission proved a catastrophe. The cult abducted Voza and dragged her off to the burial moon of Kolmar.
What happened next? The moon shuddered theatrically.
Well, by all accounts, they tortured her to the very brink of madness. The point where she embraced the dark side of the Force, slaughtered those who had kidnapped her, and became the true leader of the Bandor Gora.
Slipher glanced back at Maul. She started out as a Jedi, however.
Is that significant?
Maul said nothing. At last, the lift came to a halt.
If they're waiting to take us, Maul thought, this is where it will happen.
But as the doors slid open on Coghive 7's hangar bay, there were no guards waiting there to take him into custody, no armed corrections officers lying in ambush. The only activity in the bay came from a small detail of tactical landing technicians who were too busy wrestling with a pile of pallets and skids on the opposite side to take much notice of them.
Relax, Slipher said. The landing techs aren't armed, and they don't carry drop boxes, so they can't trigger the charges in your heart. I wasn't concerned.
Maul stepped out into the bay. The space was huge, erratically strewn with packing debris and empty shipping crates waiting to be returned on the next flight out. Across the open space, he saw the binary load lifter that Slipher had spoken of, although the immediate mission seemed far from his thoughts.
She's a former Jedi.
Had it not occurred to his master to tell him of this? Or had its withholding been part of the larger challenge that he'd come here to face? The realization that his mission on Coghive 7 would culminate in confrontation with a Jedi, albeit one whose powers had been corrupted into a life of organized crime and cult-based lunacy, plunged a dagger of bitterness deep into Maul's brain. It would not be Vesto Slipher that Komari Voza would be facing when she and the Bando Gora arrived here, Maul decided. Certainly, his own master intended for Maul himself to dispatch the Jedi scum personally. Was that the true test? Still seething, he slipped quickly across the hangar bay, moving through the shadows, leaving the moon behind.
What are you doing?
Slipher hissed as he hurried to keep pace.
You need to stay with me.
It's been too long since I've killed something.
Maul said,
be careful, or it might be you.
Don't be a fool. Our mission here requires both stealth and my active participation, and you know it.
Maul silenced him with a glare. But not just a glare. For the slightest of moments, he allowed himself to reach out with the Force. The moon faltered in his steps, mouth opening just wide enough to emit a glottal clicking cough, taken aback by the invisible vice grip of pressure taking hold around his neck and chest, choking as he labored to draw breath. Maul found the sharp expression of shock and fear on the banker's face only mildly gratifying, given these extenuating circumstances. He kept Slipher there for a split second, prolonging the sight of the moon's eyes bulging in their sockets. Then, leaning forward, he spoke in a whisper.
Komari Voza, he said quietly, is not the only one with the skills you mentioned. You would do well to remember that.
What?
Slipher's face tightened in an ecstasy of disbelief.
You!
Maul squeezed harder. Perhaps it was the explicit mention of the Jedi, or simply his own inability to hold back any longer. But suddenly, all he wanted was to snap the neck of this insect and finish what he'd started. Only then did he realize the sheer magnitude of his transgression, a betrayal of his purpose here, the one thing that he'd sworn not to do. Releasing Slipher, pushing him away, he pivoted and approached the larger of the binary loadlifters, stepping around behind the droid to avoid being seen by the hangar's crew members, then cast a glance back at the moon.
Is this the one?
Yes.
Slipher reached up and touched his throat, still badly shaken. He kept his distance, eyeing Maul as one might regard a vicious animal whose true nature had suddenly become abundantly evident.
I have to give my authorization first.
Then do it. We've wasted enough time.
Slipher turned to face the droid's photoreceptors, looking deeply grateful to have something else upon which to focus his attention.
IBC Yellow Card Security Variant 377055, he said. Voice verify consultant Vesto Slipher.
Verifying,
The droid echoed back, joints creaking with a series of soft hydraulic noises as it straightened up.
Command prompt.
Access analytical upgrade, subroutine 1188. I'm here to pick up a package.
Accessing.
Another muffled hissing noise.
Input data format.
The CLL unit muttered something in binary that came out sounding like a series of mismatched tones, ending with a defeated electronic gurgle. Bennett's photoreceptors went dim, and it dropped both of its flat, spatulate arms to the floor with a sharp metallic clang that rang out through the hangar like blaster fire.
You!
On the far side of the hangar, Maul saw the crew of cargo technicians turning from the empty stack of packaging cartons to stare across the open space at them.
Identify yourselves! What are you doing down here? Don't come any closer!
Slipher called back.
He's going to kill me!
The crew members froze and drew back. Glancing quickly at Maul, the moon threw his hands into the air.
My name is Vesto Slipher. I'm a field support analyst for the IBC.
He cast a fearful glance at Maul.
This prisoner, inmate 11240, abducted me from my quarters and brought me down here as a hostage. He's trying to escape on the freight barge when it arrives. Alert the warden!
Then, casting his eyes at Maul once more, the banker couldn't seem to repress a small smile. I suppose you ought to have killed me when you had a chance.
Who says it's too late now?
Maul asked.
Tell me how to fix the lightsabers.
Slipher murmured.
And I'll do whatever I can with Warden Blur to see that you walk away from all of this. Otherwise, there is nothing that I can do to guarantee your safety.
Maul felt the space around him closing up like a trap.
Where's the geological compressor?
It must have not arrived yet.
Raising his voice again, Slipher called out to the men across the bay.
You men, stop wasting time! Hurry! Before he...
Shut up!
Reaching outward, Maul snatched the blue witch from the moon's grasp, then turned to the gathered crew members who were staring at him from across the bay. Slipher's moronic outburst hadn't left much to work with, but it was enough.
Don't come any closer, Maul said. Stay right where you are.
Inmate 11240, one of them shouted back. What's that in your hand?
It's a plasma detonator.
Maul held up the blue witch just high enough that they could see it, raising his voice to be heard across the hangar.
High-grade industrial munitions.
Doesn't look like any detonator I've ever seen.
Take another step and you'll see all you need of it,
Maul said.
Who wants to be first?
Don't be a fool,
Slipher murmured.
You can't.
Maul shoved him away in the direction of the other men.
You've done enough.
You're cutting me loose?
The moon reared back, incredulous.
That's insane. They'll kill you in seconds.
I'll take my chances.
Jamming the blue witch in his pocket, where its glow could be seen through the fabric of the uniform, Maul turned back to the load lifter that stood behind them. Taking hold of the thing's manipulator arm, he swung himself upward onto its main control console.
Inmate 11240, what are you doing?
Maul ignored them, focusing his attention on the load lifter. The thing's processor cowling was a single metal plate, and he pried it open, popped the bolts, and yanked it off to expose its central processor. Thanks to Trezza's instruction back on Orsis, he'd had some experience slicing into the basic motivator drives of labor droids. They all were built relatively the same.
Inmate 11240!
Stay back.
Working instinctively, he found the thing's upgraded cognitive drive and isolated the wiring that he needed to reprogram it manually. It wouldn't cause the load lifter to do anything more than malfunction, but right now, a malfunction was all he needed. The droid lurched forward, jerking its right leg up, manipulator arms raised above its head. The load lifter's great gyro-stabilized joints slammed past Slipher as it stormed headlong across the open landing deck, instantly colliding with a stack of shipping cartons. Crates fell. Pallets crashed. Maul had already jumped back down, landing on the floor in a tuck and roll as one of the load lifter's enormous flat manipulators swung in a huge arc, upending a 10-meter-high stack of pallets and skids in front of it. The empty skids tumbled, crashed, and splintered in every direction. Then it pivoted and started off in the direction of the loading crew. The men scattered, most of them heading for cover, while the deck supervisor ran for the communications center overlooking the cargo hold. Across the hold, blue strobes began swirling on both sides, splashing the walls with light, as the load lifter pivoted and began scooping up what it had knocked over, only to dump the pallets on the opposite side of where it stood.
Fool!
Slipher's voice sneered behind him, and Maul glanced back over his shoulder to see that the moon had already gotten to his feet.
Did you actually believe you could abandon me here?
He thrust out his hand.
Give me back the Blue Witch.
Maul said nothing, but it didn't matter. The banker was talking again, caught up in his own outrage and oblivious to the load lifter advancing behind him.
My intellect is vastly superior to yours in every imaginable capacity.
Slipher sneered.
Even if there was any chance that you could...
Those were his last words. All at once, from less than a meter behind him, the load lifter's flat manipulator arm came arcing upward. It caught Slipher at neck level at a perfect 45-degree angle, severing his head neatly in one easy slice and sending it spiraling through the air. The entire action was almost silent. For a split second, his decapitated body seemed to hang there on its own, and then it crumpled to the floor of the hangar bay as the load lifter's right foot came down on top of the body, crushing it beneath the full tonnage of its weight. It was an unceremonious death for Vesto Slipher, arguably one of IBC's brightest young minds, dispatched without fanfare by a machine as brainless as he was brilliant. And in the end, no one in the known galaxy seemed particularly to notice. Maul, for his part, didn't even bother looking back. Through the chaos on the far side of the bay, he saw the lift that he and Slipher had come from. He could make it from where he was in less than 5 seconds as long as none of the loading crew had blasters, which he doubted. He ran.
Purge.
I don't like it. The prison barge Purge's newly appointed navigator and second-in-command, Bisley Cloth, was at the bridge, still engaged in the process of hailing the gaudily arrayed space yacht that had positioned itself directly in front of him when the entire console erupted in a storm of proximity alarms. Cloth snapped them off briskly, taking control of the situation with a quiet confidence that belied his age. At 22, he was still a young man, but he'd already been working aboard the Purge for 5 years, since he was old enough to hire on for a full share. Hauling convicts and local scum out to various detainment stations and galactic penal colonies, including Coghive 7, wasn't the easiest way to earn a living. Yet he'd quickly gotten used to it. Most of it anyway, including the occasional unwanted encounter with tramp vessels adrift in the Outer Rim. And although the Purge was really no more than a garbage barge retrofitted with holding cells and a makeshift medbay, Cloth had a vision of one day transforming it into a floating prison of its own, one in which he might even someday be in charge. He would be Warden Cloth. Today the Purge was carrying 46 inmates, human and non-human alike.
Mr. Cloth.
That was the Purge's captain, Wyatt Styrene, limping across the bridge toward him, his pale blue eyes alight with reckless enthusiasm. A former smuggler himself, Styrene knew these uncharted systems as well as anyone Cloth had ever met, and he'd never run from a fight.
What's the word?
Proximity alarms from that space yacht? Cloth nodded, indicating the luxury ship that had still not responded to their call. I've got it under control. It's not... A sudden volley of explosions slammed into the Purge, rocking them hard enough that Cloth had to grab the console in front of him and hang on. Checking the screens before him, he saw for the first time what he'd somehow overlooked until it was too late. An attack swarm of Z-95 headhunters closing in from below them, firing on their underside in a steady volley of concussion missiles. The alarm screamed.
Where did they come from?
Cloth shouted, unaware for the moment that he was asking the question aloud. Of course the headhunters had been the ones that had triggered the proximity alarms he'd foolishly attributed to the space yacht in front of them. A ruse that he couldn't believe he'd fallen for, although Styrene's expression seemed untroubled. In fact, Cloth could have sworn the old pirate had a wry grin on his face.
They want a tussle? We'll give them a tussle.
Without glancing back at Cloth, he powered up the full retinue of the Purge's weapon suite.
Go secure our cargo, Mr. Cloth.
Captain?
Go on. I've got the bridge. Besides, he gestured toward the hatch. It's almost feeding time for them, isn't it?
Cloth strode quickly back through the Purge, nodding at the guards on either side as he opened the hatchway leading to the vessel's main hold.
Everything secure down here? Locked down?
The guard shouted back.
What's going on topside?
Not sure, Cloth said, making a split-second decision to keep the arrival of the headhunters to himself for now, for the sake of maintaining some semblance of order.
Captain's at the bridge now. It's under control.
Tell that to them,
the guard said, pointing down into the hold, where the Purge had been outfitted with its containment cells. Cloth could already hear the convicts down below, some of them screeching, shouting, or demanding answers in the near darkness. Typically the inmates they brought out to Coghive 7 had lapsed into a silent stupor of boredom by this point in the voyage, but the blaster fire had stirred them up, and Cloth heard them calling out to find out if the ship was under attack. I'm going down to check the main cargo hold, Cloth told the guard. Who else is down here?
Carrier and Hayes.
Two good men, Cloth thought, or at least battle-tested. He nodded, already ducking forward.
Tell the captain if I'm not back up in 5 minutes.
Something broadsided the vessel from amidships, heavier than a turbo laser, almost like they'd been struck by an asteroid or another ship. Cloth was already halfway down the gangway amid the holding cells when it struck, and the impact pitched him back into the console wall behind him. It was followed by an unfamiliar high-pitched grinding noise from somewhere below, like an oscillating blade shearing through steel. The guard beside him hoisted his blaster, checking the cartridge, his face drawn tight with nerves.
What the cark is that?
It feels like...
Cloth began, and the words snapped off in his throat.
It feels like we're being boarded.
Seconds later, from down below, he heard it. The voices of the prisoners had fallen absolutely silent.
Is there a ghost?
What in the name of... From behind her desk, Siddiqui Blur was watching the holoscreens that showed the events down in the cargo hold, the CLL load lifter pivoting on its gyros and thundering into the wall.
Status report. What's going on down there?
Next to her, 3D didn't respond. The droid had been trying in vain to communicate with the CLL unit for the last 5 minutes, and its silence was not reassuring.
My apologies, Warden.
3D withdrew its adapter from the wall console.
I'm afraid the load lifter's motivator has been manually compromised somehow. I cannot access it from here.
What do you mean, manually compromised?
Someone rewired it on site.
That's absurd. Cursing aloud, Siddiqui looked at the screen. The crushed remains of the decapitated and trampled Vesto Slipher were sprawled across the floor, almost unrecognizable. She had no idea what the moon had been doing down there, nor did she particularly care. The sight of his corpse elicited nothing more profound in her than a headache. But it was one more headache that she was going to have to deal with at the worst possible time. She glanced at the chrono display. What's the ETA on that incoming prison barge?
The purge is due to arrive within 30 minutes.
You've confirmed that?
Captain Styrene made contact when the vessel first came out of hyperspace. I haven't heard from them since then.
30 minutes.
Siddiqui stood with her hands gripping either side of the desk and remained there, perfectly motionless for the moment, allowing herself to take stock of the situation. By themselves, a malfunctioning droid and the untimely death of an IBC representative weren't catastrophic, but given what was at stake, she sensed the hand of something far more dangerous behind it. And why had Dakarai disappeared? Where was her brother when she needed his counsel the most?
Warden, I have Gaming Commissioner Chloros on the line. Shall I have him leave a message?
Yes. She stopped and reconsidered.
No. Wait. Put him through.
Chloros's face appeared on the screen directly in front of her. He didn't wait for her salutation.
Siddiqui, what is going on over there?
Commissioner, she smiled, finding it surprisingly easy to do. You're looking well.
Chloros held up his hand to stop her.
You're operating in direct violation of the Commission's orders to shut down your gambling operation. Now I'm getting reports of ongoing hostility between inmates and guards.
I wasn't aware that penal reform fell under the aegis of the Gaming Commission.
Don't do this, Siddiqui. Don't put me in this position.
On the contrary, Commissioner. Siddiqui's voice changed, darkening ever so slightly, her eyes never leaving his image on the screen. It's you who put me into this position. Long ago.
I failed to see it.
I didn't want to bring this up, but you've left me no choice.
She tapped a series of commands into the holo console, and a new series of images superimposed themselves over the display on the monitor.
Do you recognize this place?
For a moment, Chloros didn't answer.
Of course. It's the Outlander Casino and Resort on Coruscant.
Where we first met,
Siddiqui said as the next series of images came up.
Remember this?
Now Chloris' entire face went blank with shock as he stared at the surveillance photos.
Where did you get these?
It doesn't matter. What matters is what the board members would have to say about a respected commissioner finding himself with a young, highly impressionable casino manager in what you'll have to admit is a very compromising position.
She leaned forward slightly.
Can you see the images clearly?
I can increase the bandwidth if you prefer. There are some very good shots of...
Those photos prove nothing!
You're right. Perhaps I should just forward them to the Commission and let them draw their own conclusions.
She waited for a moment. Unless you have another suggestion.
Enough.
Chloris's shoulder sagged.
What is it that you want?
Ah... Siddiqui nodded. Now we're making progress. Here's how it's going to work. As soon as we finish this conversation, you're going to reverse your ruling against my operation, reinstating Coghive 7's rights and privileges as a gaming facility under the Commission's regulations, making it fully operational, effective immediately.
I couldn't possibly...
And... I want you to contact your friend Lars Winnick at the IBC and come up with a plausible explanation for the unexpected disappearance of one of their field agents.
What?
His name is Vesto Slipher. I'll send the specifics along directly. How you manage it does not concern me, as long as I'm not subjected to any more of these degrading spot audits.
Siddiqui?
Cloris reached up to clutch at the collar of his tunic, struggling to loosen it.
You grossly overestimate my scope of influence in these matters.
And you, Dragomir, grossly underestimate the amount of damage that these surveillance photos could inflict on your career, she said. You've done great things for the Commission, and the relationship between gambling communities. You've driven galactic revenue to new heights. A man like you might be senator one day. And after that, who knows?
She let the words sink in, knowing they would saturate his colossal ego.
Do you really want to throw all that away over some cheap tryst with a casino manager?
Cloris gazed at her. A faintly gleaming mustache of sweat had broken out across his upper lip, and his eyes looked raw, rimmed with red. Finally, he shook his head.
I forgot how obstinate you become when you want something.
Don't forget again, Siddiqui told him.
And before he could answer, she pressed the button to break off the transmission. She heard 3D approaching her with a refill of her coffee.
Well done, if I may say so.
Child's play.
She held out the cup, allowing him to fill it. Where's inmate 11240? 3D turned to her, not understanding.
Excuse me?
Clear the monitors. Show me all the tunnels and lifts leading away from the cargo bay. Roll the feedback 5 minutes. Do it now. The holoscreens flickered and changed, displaying a dozen different walkways, every possible exit from the cargo bay. Siddiqui took her time examining each screen individually, using the time to consider what had just happened. She hadn't wanted to confront Cloris with the surveillance photos, not because she didn't want to humiliate him. The man's reputation, like his towering vanity and none-too-secret political ambitions, could not have mattered to her less, but because the photos represented the last and most potent form of leverage that she had over the Gaming Commission. Every predatory instinct within her had wanted to hold on to the images until they could be exploited for maximum value. Now they were out there, and she froze, her thoughts breaking off as she caught sight of something on one of the screens, an odd bluish blur in the corner of one of the turbo lifts. From here it looked like nothing more than a visual aberration, like a ripple of slightly discolored heat from an exhaust vent. Except that there were no such vents in the lift, and the ripple shifted noticeably. Siddiqui leaned closer, staring at the image. There was something inside the lift. Something that didn't want to be seen. She hit the alarm.
Fifty-four. Hot box.
The lift stopped, and Mole knew he'd been caught. He glanced down at the blue witch in his hand and then dropped it with disgust, letting it hit the floor with a clink. It rolled to the corner and lay there spluttering feebly for a moment before finally dying out. It served him right for trusting the moon's gadget for an instant longer than he had to. He never should have taken the lift back up from the cargo bay. Now he was trapped in here. For an instant, he imagined Slipher's severed head lying in the corner laughing at him. No matter. Such thoughts were useless to him now. He glanced up at the ceiling, a meter above his head, and then the walls around him, instinctively taking stock of any possible way out. Suddenly, the lift itself felt very small, more like a cage or a coffin. Bracing his hands on one smooth wall and his legs on the other, he lifted himself upward and began to climb his way to the ceiling. It was a slow process. but there was a maintenance hatch up there, in all likelihood bolted shut from the outside. He didn't know if he'd be able to get it open without losing his grip on the walls, and even if he did...
Very impressive,
a woman's voice said from the speaker inside the lift, a voice that Maul recognized immediately as belonging to Siddiqui Blur.
Of course, at this point, I should have expected nothing less from Coghive 7's most celebrated inmate.
Ignoring her, Maul crawled another meter upward, keeping his arms, legs, and shoulders rigid to hold himself in position. At this angle, the only way to get the hatch open would be to slam his head against it.
There's no sense trying to get out that way. The lift is industrial grade, durasteel reinforced from the outside. We use it to transport our more imposing inmates, like that Wampa you fought. It's got some very interesting features, from my perspective at least.
Something clicked and began to hum inside the walls.
Even if you manage to escape, there's nothing inside the shaft to hold on to, which means you'll die in there, either slowly or quickly, depending on how ambitious you are.
Maul said nothing.
Still determined to injure yourself? Here, let me help you.
The lift jerked upward, then plunged. Maul slammed face first into the ceiling as it dropped straight down. It halted, and he hit the floor hard. Sprawled on his back with the wall spinning around him, he reflexively shot out his arms and legs again to stabilize himself for the next move. But the lift began to rise smoothly upward again, as if nothing had disturbed its passage.
I'd like to make you a proposition. As you may have guessed, we don't get many inmates like you in here. In fact, you're arguably one of a kind. So, in the spirit of entrepreneurial enterprise, I'd like to do the only thing that makes any sense.
Maul glared at the speaker.
Kill yourself and save the universe the trouble?
Not quite. I'd like to offer you a job.
My answer is no.
You haven't heard my terms.
It doesn't matter.
His expression remained unchanged.
I prefer death.
At least do yourself the courtesy of admitting you're curious. You seem almost supernaturally adept at isolating and exploiting the weaknesses of your opponents under the most adverse of circumstances. So.
She paused long enough for Maul to wonder if he was supposed to be hanging on her every word.
This is what I propose. You come to work here in the executive level of Coghive 7, where you will report directly to me. There are certain aspects of our operation here that you might find very illuminating.
What aspects?
Before I get into the details, I would expect an oath of absolute loyalty. Of course, you'll enjoy complete autonomy, stay here in a luxury suite, and receive a generous salary that reflects exactly how valuable you truly are to this operation. Who knows?
Something eased into her voice, a note of bemusement that Maul could actually hear, though he couldn't see her face.
You may even discover what you've been searching for all along. What do you say?
You're forgetting one thing,
Maul said, bracing himself against the wall opposite the speaker.
What's that?
This place where you live.
Yes?
It's still a prison.
Pumping one leg straight out, he drove his heel into the speaker and smashed it to pieces, strangling the warden's voice off into a fuzzy, digitized warble, and then silence. The speaker itself popped loose from its housing, dangling down on a tangle of multicolored wiring. Seconds later, the lift stopped again. He'd expected nothing less. Having not received the answer she wanted, the warden was going to make him hurt. Apparently, she wasn't ready to trigger the charges implanted in his heart, but she wasn't going to let him get away either. Working quickly, Maw yanked the dislodged speaker plating from its wires, paused just long enough to inspect the beveled edge, and decided that it would have to suffice, and began the slow creeping process back up toward the hatchway at the top of the lift. Halfway up, he noticed it. Around him, the Durasteel walls were starting to get hot.
"55, inbound flight."
C.O. Dawson was on site when the prison barge Purge docked outside the Hive's loading bay. But he didn't actually see the action. Not all of it, anyway. Later on, he would testify before a Galactic Board of Inquiry that the only reason he'd survived was that he hadn't stuck around to watch it all go down. That wasn't quite the truth, but it was close enough. And by that time, there wasn't anybody else left to contradict him. He was on deck with a dozen other guards and the prison's loading and landing crew as the Purge settled creakingly into its docking berth just outside the space station. Like most of the freighters and transport ships that arrived here, the barge was far too big to land inside the hangar, so that docking became a ritualized mating ceremony of pressurized coupling adapters and a long extendable gangway whose port extended down into the cargo hold itself. When the port finally opened, Dawson and the other guards straightened up, each of them gripping ghost sticks and stun pikes, awaiting the signal from Doyle, the chief gantry officer on duty, that typically indicated the offloading of new prisoners and supplies. Standard loading and unloading protocol was that the Purge's own guards would step off first, with inmates to follow. Dawson and the others stood staring expectantly at the open port. But the port remained empty. "Come on." After a moment, Dawson glanced at the guard next to him in annoyance. "What's this about?" he muttered. "I was supposed to be off shift 20 minutes ago. Now we gotta stay here waiting for..." He broke off mid-sentence. Two nervous-looking guards had just stepped out of the port, each of them struggling to hold up one end of an ungainly, heavy-looking shipping crate. They were followed by four more guards, escorting a group of nine prisoners. At least they were wearing prison uniforms, although C.O. Dawson thought these creatures were even more imposing than what he was used to. Trandoshans, Gamorreans, Gran. Species that he'd tangled with before, certainly, but never altogether like this. And then he realized why they looked so dangerous. They were all smiling. Grinning, actually. "Scrummy-looking buggers, aren't they?" Dawson growled, tightening his grip on his static pike, already thumbing the power button and wishing they'd been armed with blasters. He didn't like the feel of things, and was already aware of an unpleasant tension gathering in his lungs, making him feel as though his uniform was buttoned too tightly across his chest and throat. Lately there had been a paranoid air of skullduggery inside the prison itself. Rumors that the Huts or other crime syndicates had been sending their own people in as inmates, or even guards to undermine operations here. Dawson didn't believe it, but the possibility still made him uneasy. He glanced back at the other guard, Greer.
"Let's knock some of the snark off their faces, shall we?"
"The matches will do that soon enough," Greer murmured back. "But I'm not sure I'm willing to wait that long."
"Me either."
They stepped forward, pikes at the ready. The guards carrying the shipping crate had stopped 10 meters in front of them and put it down with a noticeable expression of relief. Eyeing the inmates, Dawson and the others came forward to receive them. "Gentlemen, welcome." Siddiqui Blur spoke up from behind them, and Dawson glanced back over his shoulder to see the warden standing there along with her droid. Dawson took his hand off the butt of his static pike and forced himself to calm down. It was highly unorthodox for management to come down personally to supervise the offloading of new inmates, and he wondered if there was something special about this entire operation after all. Warden Blur eyed the inmates and the guards who escorted them.
Where's your captain?
Still aboard the vessel.
Captain Styrene usually comes down to greet me himself, she said, and turned to the new inmates. How many are there?
Just these 9.
Only 9? Siddiqui glanced at the droid for verification. We were supposed to receive 32 inmates.
Just 9,
the guard answered back stiffly. And Dawson noticed the man's eyes flicking anxiously back toward the docking module, as if he couldn't wait to get back aboard, or anywhere for that matter, as long as it wasn't here. Frowning, Siddiqui approached the shipping crate. What about the freight? Is this all of it?
Everything on our manifest.
I highly doubt that.
See for yourself.
Thank you, Siddiqui said.
I will.
As she walked over to inspect the crate, Dawson saw the whole thing shift slightly to the right. Whatever was in there was large enough to make the entire crate move. He was already opening his mouth to shout out a warning when the lid burst open.
Warden!
Dawson started, but that was all he had time for. The Trandoshan who'd been hiding inside the crate had a Westar M5 blaster rifle in both hands. By the time Warden Blur dropped to the floor, her reflexes, Dawson realized, had just saved her life. The Shan was already firing point-blank into the group of guards directly in front of him. Blaster bolts streaked flickering ribbons of death into the unsuspecting front line of Coghive 7 COs, and everything around him started happening with dreamlike clarity. Dawson saw Greer, the guard 2 meters away from him, go ragdolling backward across the floor of the hangar with a sizzling hole in his chest, leaving nothing more behind him than a stinking cloud of burned flesh and fabric. Blinking, Dawson recoiled and hit the floor. He could hear the warden's administrative droid clucking out panicked noises in the distance. Somewhere off to his right, Warden Blur herself had disappeared completely from sight. Hit or not, he couldn't tell, nor at this moment did he particularly care. The thought that kept circling through his mind, this can't be happening, whatever it is,